Vodka O'Clock.
Hey everyone, it's Amber Love, and you're listening to Vodka O'Clock podcast from AmberUnmasked.com. And you can now sponsor the show on the website at Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/AmberUnmasked, and you can pledge as little as a dollar per creation, which means a dollar a week. So today, my guest is Jeremy Whitley. We're going to be talking about all kinds of comic book stuff, and we're going to get into, like, why he writes the things he writes, and, you know, what it's like to... What's it like to break in? Okay, we're gonna do that kind of thing. So you probably already know him, but in case you don't, Jeremy Whitley's here. We're gonna talk about Princeless and everything else he's working on. So welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So with Princeless, this is a series that started a few years ago. Now, are you like the creator, or was this a joint venture from the beginning?
Well, officially, I am co-creators along with my artist on the book, Emily Martin. It was originally something that, you know, came from my brain, and you know, I had another version of it at one point, and then you know, I did the first volume with Mia Goodwin, you know, but since then she'd sort of moved on to do her own thing, and Emily's come on as the regular artist and the co-creator on the book.
And now I know it's not all about you know, being famous in comics, because that never happens. Mm-hmm. But Princeless has gotten a few awards and some really lovely award recognition and everything. So congratulations on all that, because it deserves it.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I think last time we talked, it might have been, you know, way back when Princeless had just been, you know, nominated for a couple of Eisner Awards and had won a few Glyph Awards as well, you know, back for the first volume. And obviously since then we've had 2.5 more volumes, and we're chugging right along right now. We've got, you know, a spin-off series in The Pirate Princess, and whole lot of other stuff coming out, hopefully for regular on a regular basis for a while.
Okay, so if you guys are listening and you're wondering, you know, what kind of book this is, that it got so much recognition and a lot of praise from the fan community and from fellow creators, you know, like Gail Simone and like people who have been out there for a long time have really helped promote this series. It's the story about Princess Adrienne, who just does not want to wait for a prince to come save her from her tower. So she breaks out and she makes friends, and they go on a long quest to help other princesses escape their towers. And from there, it's just like this big rolling adventure from one challenge and one you know, task to the next. So it's pretty cool, and I like the like B story that's in there with Adrian's brother, how you really just he's not like the manly man that his, you know, his father the king wants him to be. And I think it's been a really sweet like little side story.
Thank you. Yeah, I think it's we set out from the beginning to do you know, a couple of different stories within this. I mean, it's definitely Adrian's story, but you know, Devin is her twin brother, and is experiencing a lot of the same, you know, problems and prejudice as she is, but from the other side, you know, whereas she is a girl who, you know, is adventuring and sword fighting and doing things that are generally deemed as being too masculine for her. He, on the other hand, is much more into the sort of things that, you know, their parents would rather Adrian was into. And, you know, at the same time, they don't want him to be into that. He is an artist and a poet and an actor and a seamster. He makes costumes and sews and everything as well.
Yeah, he's a great fashion designer for the theater. So where did the whole series come from? That, because I mean, it's been a few years, and I was wondering if, you know, being a parent really was why you made this? Like, if there was something that just, you know, your daughter influenced you so much to make it, or if it was just something that was probably in your head for a really long time, or, you know, just it, you took a dramatic shift where you were maybe a horror guy 10 years ago, and now you're writing about princesses. Like, what? How did this become your story?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of a combination of it being something that had been in my head and being something that is influenced by being a parent. You know, at the point I started writing it, I wasn't yet a parent, but my wife and I were talking about it, and it was something that I loved comics, and I wanted to share comics with my daughter, and I wanted there to be comics worth sharing, and that I was confident in sharing, and felt good about putting in her hands, where, you know, she could see young women who looked like herself, you know, young women of color, doing things for themselves, being the heroes of the story, and actually, you know, having their own agency and their own perception of their destiny, you know, because that's unfortunately not something that a lot of the existing princesses, especially at the time, it's improved a little bit since then, but, you know, overall, it's still not something that a lot of the princess stories that are presented to young girls as being for them actually go out of their way to discuss or embrace. And especially, there's especially few with, you know, women of color as the leads, and comics suffers largely from the same issue in that there's not many leads of color, and then the few things that are out there with leads of color are very... are often not designed for kids, or, you know, even to be looked at by kids. Unfortunately, there's a large problem with, you know, over-sexualization of characters in comics, even ones who are supposed to be not particularly of a sexual nature. And then I wanted my daughter to have something that I felt comfortable giving her, and that hopefully she could aspire towards in some way. So I started writing it, and in the time that I was, you know, working on volume one, actually had a daughter. You know, we continued to put it together, and this story has been kind of growing with us, and it's all about her going off to go, you know, rescue her other sisters. And we've also had the, you know, the awesome sort of addition of Raven, the pirate princess, throughout this, which was something at the time I hadn't anticipated, but it's sort of grown organically out of the story and has taken on sort of a life of its own.
Well, let's talk about that specific part, because I think it's so incredible when an indie comic book does not only succeed, but it succeeds well enough that you can have a spinoff like this and had people that want to draw variant covers, and, you know, have such a great reaction from other creators themselves to, you know, to expand the universe and to get their own versions of things out there. And I don't know if we've seen any cosplay yet, but it should totally happen, because Adrian's armor is pretty, you know, awesome. But I love the pirate story, and it feels a little bit older maybe than Adrian's story. But it's still, like, it's just very, it's very consistent. And was there some sort of, like, big, like, you know, marketing secret that you did to just, like, get the word out? And it, or was it just, like, holy crap, this just happened, and people like my book?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was, you know, it was obviously something that I was looking for, and I couldn't find at the time that I was looking for it, so I ended up making it, and I think it's proven that there are quite a few other people out there looking for the same thing, or something similar, and it's been interesting to sort of see that evolve, and, you know, it's something that's done much better over time, and in the book market as compared to, you know, exclusively the comic direct market. It's been really really interesting because it was, you know, something that we that I wanted to do, and basically over the first, you know, year or two it was coming out, just talked to anybody who would listen about it, you know, did all the interviews that I could manage to do, you know, pushed it on every critic who would take a look at it, and you know, was nice enough to have both some receptive critics and receptive pros who you know, picked it up and were excited about it and went out and talked about it to other people. Both Gail Simone and Kelly Sue DeConnick have been big supporters of it throughout. Matt Fraction's also been really great. Greg Pak is somebody who's been really supportive of, you know, of these stories, and it's been amazing to me to have gone from, you know, having to explain what Princeless is to every person that comes down the aisle, and them not know, to meeting professionals for the first time that I've never met, and you know, having them compliment me on my work and say, you know, how excited they are about Princeless. I mean, it was great. The first time I ever met Marjorie Liu, like, I met her and her boyfriend Juno Diaz, and they were sort of they both were familiar with the book, and you know, had nothing but nice things to say, and it was it's one of those shocking moments where, you know, you go from having to sort of explain what and who what you do and who you are to everybody to like the first time somebody actually knows beforehand.
That's pretty amazing. It's got to be a great feeling. Do you also go on to panels for when you get to a Comic-Con? Do you panels a lot?
Yeah, I do as many panels as anybody will let me. You know, I am actually pretty bad at turning down panels when people ask me. For anybody who was at AwesomeCon this last year in D.C., I did 7 panels over the weekend, which is borderline suicidal, because, you know, I was running my own table and doing 7 panels, so I was, you know, running back and forth to these panels and back to my table and trying to sell as many books as I could before I had to run back out to do another panel. And at one point I had, I think, 3 panels within 4 hours. So yeah, I do. I'm a tireless promoter. You know, like I was talking about with putting the book into, you know, the hands of critics and pros. I also, you know, will do pretty much any panel or any event that I think has an audience that can benefit from Princeless or that would be interested in Princess.
Things that I saw recently on your feed was that you and your daughter went to go teach about making comics and stuff. So was that in a library or a school?
That particular one was actually in a Barnes & Noble. We went to I actually did a couple of Barnes & Nobles within they were doing a whole week devoted to geek media kind of stuff, and I went to 2 Barnes & Nobles here in North Carolina and talked about my comics and just generally making comics and how to get into making comics, how to break into the industry, what you know, what it's all about, what's you know, everything from how to write a script to like how did I, you know, get in to do something at you know, with Action Lab or at Marvel for that matter. How did I get to writing My Little Pony from, you know, not having been involved at all with IDW previous to that?
And what is it like for kids, that, like teaching to kids these things? Because I've never actually seen that done before. Except like we have kids that come to our fundraiser and everything. I see kids running around in costumes and at some panels, but I've never seen anything that's that's really like an educational experience about this is how we do it, and then, you know, showing them this is what a script looks like. What do they respond to? Because they're growing up in a whole different world with digital media. You know, do they even know what a comic book is?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of kids are very familiar with comic books generally in the non-floppy, you know, trade style form. And a lot of them are more familiar with manga than Western style comic books. So, you know, there is some familiarity. They know what it is and they're interested in it. They all know, you know, most of them above a certain age have seen some number of at least the Marvel movies, and, you know about superheroes, watch the cartoons and all that. So, I mean, it's not something where you have to start quite at the very beginning, thankfully. I think it helps having things that they can relate to that they're aware of already, like, you know, My Little Pony, being able to say, well, you know that show that you watch that's on the TV, you know, that's also a comic. You can read that TV show that you watch, and there's, you know, even more stories that you haven't heard or seen yet, you know, because that's an exciting thing for anybody to, you know, learn that there's more of a thing that they love. There's definitely a certain class of girl that when, you know, I pitch Princeless to them when I tell, you know, it's about a princess who, you know, makes friends with her dragon and goes out and kicks butt, that, you know, there are some girls that immediately they're like, yeah, that's what I want. Mom, can we get this? You know, I don't think there's... I think there's, thankfully, not as much of a border between reading comics and making comics as there used to be. It's always great to see, you know, kids and teenagers who see what I'm doing, and, you know, when I explain kind of how I make stuff, and they go, oh, I can do that, and in some cases they're already doing it.
Well, you mentioned, you know, working for Marvel and IDW, in particular My Little Pony, and I pick up a My Little Pony issue here and there, like, when I can, because they're so funny, and it's not like you particularly need to follow big, giant continuity arcs or anything with My Little Pony. And they also have shorter arcs or one-shots and things that come out on occasion. So what exactly did you work on for My Little Pony?
I was working on Princeless already, and I met Tony Fleece, who draws for My Little Pony, at Denver Comic Con a couple of years ago. We were set up back to back, and he was familiar with Princeless and liked it, and, you know, asked me if I'd ever thought about working on the My Little Pony book, which was already up and rolling at that point. And I said that I'd love to. I was familiar with the show because I'd been watching it with my daughter, because it's one of those few shows that she likes and I can stand. And so, you know, I knew it was a well-written show with sort of clever, interesting stuff to say for, you know, for a kid's cartoon. And so I took him up on it. I sort of launched into talking to the editor over there about putting together some pitches. And at that point, they were launching what's called the My Little Pony Friends Forever series, which is basically a My Little Pony team-up series, right? You take, you know, two of the characters and tell a story where, you know, both of them learn something about friendship and they get closer over the course of the issue. I pitched a bunch of stuff for that. Two of the first handful of pitches I'd sent him got accepted and picked up. And I just sort of went off to the races there. I've done something around a dozen My Little Pony comics in the last year and a half. I've got my first big four-issue arc starting up next month in the book, with my epic and it's sometimes fairly dark pony story called Siege of the Crystal Empire.
That sounds cool. Well, but the show actually did go to a kind of a dark place. Like, it has, you know, big nightmare dark communities trying to take over Equestria.
Oh yeah, it's.
It's not. They don't. You know, they don't dumb it down. Like you said, it's clever. The characters, you know, are all. You know, the kind of, like, each character represents kind of, like, a set of personality traits and stuff. But, I mean, it's really clever in how they all work together.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's an incredibly well-written show, and the comic book definitely aspires to the same level of quality and intelligence. And, you know, we've got two sort of ongoing series out of it with a variety of different, you know, excellent writers and artists working on it, and it does vary from you know, the crazy and goofy to the you know, dark and sometimes serious, because the show, and it's even this current iteration, is actually not, I don't think, as dark as some of the earlier, in some cases more kind of cute bubblegum pink iterations of My Little Pony. And that, you know, like, old school My Little Pony from, like, when we were kids there were demons in that. Like, they fought some serious evil stuff.
Well, you mentioned Tony Fleece, and he's a phenomenal artist. But, I mean, did you take over for Katie Cook and Andy Price, or are they doing the other, a second series?
It's sort of a... I want to say a revolving door. That sounds like a negative thing. But people are sort of always pitching stories for both books, depending on, you know, what type of story they have in mind. And, you know, as stuff lands, you know, it has to get approved by our editor, Bobby, and then it has to go through Hasbro's approval. And, you know, at the point it gets through Hasbro's approval, Bobby starts scheduling things out. So, you know, in a lot of cases, I'll have, you know, this Siege of the Crystal Empire stuff was approved months back. And I've worked at this point with, you know, up till this point had been every artist that's been on the book except Andy Price. And then, this current volume I'm working on is with Andy Price. So now the only person I haven't worked with is Jay Foskett, who just joined the team. But everybody else that's on the Pony art team, I've done issues with, and, you know, Andy is on for the full 4-issue run of Siege of the Crystal Empire, and he's doing a phenomenal job.
I love it. I really do. And I mean, you know, it's cool how you can still see that there's a consistency, obviously, because it's a Hasbro product. So just like with Warner Brothers, you have to meet their criteria. I mean, you can't just draw it any way that you want, or write it any way that you want. But each artist still has sort of like their own touch. Like, you could tell that it's theirs and stuff. Like, Amy Memberson has done covers. Like, so many people have done covers. They're really cool. But I love it because, even though, like, it's considered a little girl's story or whatever, so many guys work on My Little Pony.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's, I think the teams are pretty close to even, you know, as far as girl-guy ratio. You know, because it's me and Andy and Tony and Jay and I'm forgetting somebody. Ted Anderson, who is also a writer. And then, you know, Tom Zoller, who's also phenomenal. As a writer and an artist. But then, you know, on the girl side, we have, obviously Katie, who, you know, writes and draws, Amy Meverson, just a, you know, an amazing group of artists with, I'm trying to think of everybody that we have. We have, Brenda, who I'm doing a, story with next month as well. We have Jen Blake, who just did a story with me a little while ago. And, of course, Agnes Grabowska, who's, you know, everybody's favorite person in general.
Exactly, yes. There's, again, when it comes to ponies, I mean, they have again, published through IDW if you haven't looked it up. They also have a gajillion variant covers for people who get really, really into collecting.
Oh, yeah.
Some of them are, like, specific for certain stores and whatever, and they might do just, like, really, like, bonus things for special issues or whatever. But they just seem to, like, when you get, unless this is just, like, done in the trades, I don't know, but it's, like, you'll get, like, this big, huge gallery of covers that came out for whatever that volume was. And it's just like, everybody loves My Little Ponies.
Oh yeah, there's a lot of folks that have done covers for it, and you know, there's usually for every issue there's, you know, two standard covers, and then, you know, in some cases there will be variants. I know Jetpack Comics does a lot of variants. Hot Topic does variants in the main series, and then there's a lot of other stores that'll, you know, do one here and there. But yeah, and there's, you know, that's a lot of where you see a lot of Tony and Amy's work, is both of them do a lot of covers. Amy does most of the main covers for the series. She has a really very clean kind of digital style that looks a lot like the actual cartoon, you know, not just stylistically, but, you know, it looks like the ponies may just start moving and having a cartoon while you're looking at it. But yeah, it's a huge team that works on Pony stuff, and they're all fantastic. I've met everybody at this point, and there's nobody I wouldn't want to work with on other projects.
When it comes to working on such a big team, like you said, that's a lot of people, you know, sort of like the kids equivalent to the, you know, the goth. Do you guys have to confer with each other, or is it just all funneled through editorial?
I mean, I always try to chat with whoever the artist is on my issues, just because in a lot of cases that can make things easier. You know, I can I know, you know, there's a case where I was talking to Andy at San Diego a month back, and you know, we were discussing something or other that was totally unrelated, and he goes, you know, that reminds me, I was reading this page in your script, and I don't understand what you're talking about here, and, you know, was asking me about, you know, one of the panels, what I was looking for there, and, you know, I was able to sort of paint not an actual picture, because that would be terrible, but like, you know, kind of an idea of what I was looking for, and then get it cleared up, and, you know, I'm good friends with several of the artists, so it's nice to sort of chit-chat with them. Everybody's got a slightly different style. I know some of the artists kind of just, I send off my script, and then I get finished pages, and I go, oh, it's fantastic. I had no idea I had even done pencils yet. And, you know, some people I sort of go more back and forth with. But, yeah, as far as other writers, other than sort of joking with people about the various receptions that various books get, and you know, trying to make sure that nothing directly conflicts as far as actual story. We don't really confer about what we're going to write very much. It's sort of you know, sit back and be surprised by where somebody else is taking the story.
Is there like a perfect story for ponies that you think, you know, maybe it would just have to, the perfect storm would have to happen with, like, you know, you writing, dream artists, because all of these others are so great. Everybody loves it. I'm not really sure if the ponies, how many awards they get. I mean, I've nominated them before because I like kids' books, so I always want to promote kids' books. But is there, you know, do you have it in the back of your head, like, oh my gosh, this is the biggest thing?
I've always got ideas of stories I want to do, and some of them have been shut down by Hasbro, not necessarily for being too big, but being sort of outside of what they've established, and, you know, something that they're worried can be, can affect where the show can go. Especially when the show already has things planned. So, you know, I've had some stories that I really wanted to do that have ended up not making the cut, and then I've had ones like, you know, the one I'm about to do, which, you know, I was writing and I kept waiting for it, for a script to come back and for Hasbro to have said, no, you've gone too far with this. You gotta chill out. This is, you know, too dark. This is too much. And, they never did. I just kept getting, almost no notes on this series. And, you know, I actually met our Hasbro guy, who's the brand manager for Hasbro that works with IDW at San Diego, and he was thrilled about the story that we were doing, and I was astonished because I thought for sure that, you know, at some point that one was going to get shut down, and it didn't. It just kept doing better, and in this case, you know, seems to have actually made some impact with Hasbro, so I'm hoping that'll do the same with the audience. And yeah, I've never gotten the chance to work with Andy as much as I love working with everybody else. This is my first time working with who Andy is widely considered, I think, to be the premier pony artist at this point. So yeah, I think this for now is that thing. I really want to do more sort of origin stories. I really enjoyed the origin story that I did for Sombra with Brenda Higgy during Villains Month, and that so far has been, I think, the best received thing I've done. But I have some ideas for both Discord and Zecora that, you know, I'd like to see some version of actually come around at some point. But I've yet to hit a note with them that the folks at Hasbro like or are not anticipating covering themselves at some point, which is the biggest struggle with trying to tell big stories for a license like this that still has an ongoing show, is, you know, if it's a really good big story, they're probably already wanting to do it at some point on the show. So you kind of got to skirt what the show is planning on doing and still try and make something that's big.
Yeah, that's a sport. That was the name of it. So when it comes to the time that it takes to turn over and everything with Hasbro, it's like, do you have the kind of freedom that you can create new characters, or at that point is it like, oh no, now we have to go to committee because now you're starting to mess with the universe?
For the most part, Hasbro has been exceptionally easy to work with. You know, I have tried to work with some license holders before, and it's not always an easy thing. Usually when Hasbro turns something down, there's a very clear idea of why they're turning it down. And, you know, in a lot of cases, they're willing to sort of shoot it down and say, you know, here's the reason. If you come back to us with something that can integrate, you know, some of what you're doing here without, you know, doing this thing that's sort of unbalancing our universe, then we'll look at it again. In fact, this story, Rise of the Crystal Empire, or Siege of the Crystal Empire, started off as a sort of... And it's always been sort of a villain team-up story, but the you know, who the big villain was initially, and from the first time I pitched it, has changed. You know, the story that I started out doing was not, you know, not something Hasbro was interested in, and sort of conflicted with some of the stuff they were doing in-house. So, you know, I sort of took it and looked at it some more, and while that was happening, the Fiendship is Magic, the Villain Month stuff started up, and I ended up getting sort of another idea from there that, you know, enabled me to combine these two ideas and make, I think, what's now a bigger and better thing.
So You've mentioned how it's, you know, how there have been times when they've passed on things. So as a writer, I'm really curious because I read something, and I don't even remember the source of this, where it said that when men get rejected from a publisher and they're told to resubmit, that they actually do then resubmit something, whereas women are less likely to even try again. They just take the rejection and they go elsewhere. They're, you know, like they don't want to face that company again or that publisher or whatever it is. How what advice do you have on this pitching process that, you know, how do you take what they're saying and then say, okay, I'm just going to sink this into the bin and then start, you know, try again and start fresh again?
I think, the biggest things to realize, with that are one that, you know, when you write a good story, even if that story can't be made the way it is, you know, there are always elements of that story that can survive and can, you know, move on to another iteration. And it's important not to, you know, throw the baby out with the bathwater, you know, so to speak, when you have a good idea, don't let that good idea go just because, you know, it's in the wrong packaging at the moment. You got to kind of hold on to that kernel of what was good about it and come back to it. And I think the other thing to realize is that, and a lot of this depends on the editor and, you know, Bobby is really good and really supportive in this, right? And that, you know, the editor has a good idea of what will fly and what won't. And if he tells, you know, if he says resubmit something, he means resubmit it. Like, he doesn't, you know, he's not somebody who has a lot of time to just keep having you resubmit the thing that he's never going to pass. You know, there are some, you know, people who sort of thrive off of going through the recycling and turning people down, but I think for the most part, when you get to, you know, professional comic book editors, there is so much involved in that job that if they're telling you to resubmit, if they're telling you to try again, then they're not, you know, blowing smoke up your butt. They actually want you to resubmit because they don't have time to look at stuff that they're not interested in.
You know, suck it up. It's okay. Everybody does have to work once in a while, or you just do something that's not a for that brand. You know, sometimes that's, and because I hear that a lot too, where publishers or agents just be like, look at me, this just isn't the right thing for me. And that's something that you have to be like, okay. And At some point, whatever the magic number is, you get enough rejections where then you start seeing it as just part of the process. But when you're new, and it's like, you know, I'm still getting rejected all the time. I'm terrible. I don't know. I don't know if it's a year's amount of time that you're doing something, or if it has anything to do with finding success in one thing, like you had so much success in Princeless that maybe the rejections don't even bother you.
No, I mean, it's you know, that's something that has bothered me in the past and still does on occasion. Especially, I think having Princeless in some respects made it more difficult for me because I can say, like, I can look at Princeless and say, I know what I'm doing. Why can't I figure out how to make other people realize that I know what I'm doing? And it's not an easy thing to do necessarily. I think part of the hard part of it is, looking at your project after it's been rejected and being able to say, all right, now this is a good idea. This is something I want to do, or, you know, to look at the rejection and look at their reasons and go, is it me or is it them? Is this an issue that they just don't want this kind of book, that they don't want this kind of idea, that this isn't up their alley, and that I've just been pitching to the wrong place? Or is it something that's actually wrong with the story? Because, I mean, it's hard to admit that there's something wrong with your story, but at the same time, it's just as difficult sometimes to, you know, kind of swallow back the tears and the self-pity and go, no, there's a good idea here. I'm going to keep pursuing it. You know, because there's always going to be something that, you know, holds you back, and you've got to learn to minimize the part of that that's just you holding you back, and, you know, figure out how to kind of step into it and keep being willing to take those types of punches, because if you're going to be a professional writer and you're not just going to do your own thing by yourself in your own little corner, then you gotta learn to be rejected. You know, I've got a story, a pitch I've been working on for Oni, that has been bouncing around at this point for a solid 6 months. You know, every time I put it together and I send it to them, I think I've got it, and then I get a letter or a conversation where, you know, they say, well, there's just this one thing. It's still a little bit off. Have you looked at this? And, they'll point it out to me, and I'll go, oh, yeah, that's obviously wrong. That obviously doesn't work. It would obviously work better if I did this, this, and this. And I think part of being a writer and being successful as a writer is being able to look at critiques that you get, especially from editors, and being able to process them and realize that, like, this is somebody that does this professionally. They might be seeing this more clearly than you are. And then in some cases, just be able to look at it and go, no, this is what I want to do. If this isn't what they want, then maybe I should look somewhere else.
Okay, so I have to know, which pony are you? Because everybody sits around and picks out, you know, the pony that's them. And because, you know, obviously Twilight Sparkle was the main character in the cartoon. But, you know, Rarity is the fashion designer, so I know my cosplay friends all think that they're Rarity. And if somebody were to ask me, I can't even remember her name, though. It was Applejack's, like, grandma that sat in a rocking chair. Like, me on the farm in a rocking chair with me.
Yeah, Granny Smith. It's difficult to say. I've been asked this question many times, and I identify with a couple of the characters. Twilight Sparkle is often my favorite to write, because, you know, she reminds me a lot of myself and of my wife in several respects, being sort of the nerdy, introverted, book loving type. And I love her as a character, and in a lot of respects at the same time, I'm not nearly as organized as Twilight Sparkle. I don't know. I don't know that there's a character that matches me dead on, but I think in a lot of respects, I'm probably closest to Big Mac, and I'm just I'm sometimes the big galoot that's just there to go, yup, about stuff. So.
Here, this is heavy. Carry it.
Yep.
Because I have a friend who I always said she was Pinkie Pie, and she had never even seen the show, and it was one of those things where I started sending her, like, a bunch of graphics that I got on the internet, and then I was like, please, it's on Netflix. Please go watch the show. And she didn't realize. She's like, wow, oh my God, you're right. I'm like, you're Pinkie Pie. It's like, and if you guys are listening, I'm sorry, we're, like, nerding out about ponies. But Pinkie Pie is, like, hyperactive, addicted to sugar. And at some point, she got, like, so hyper, she multiplied herself.
Yeah. She couldn't stand missing out on all the things she was missing out on by just being one pony. So she had to clone herself.
Yeah, she cloned herself straight into a special pool of water. Fantastic. Okay, well, so just to before we run out of time or anything, since we're talking about, you know, ponies and princess and these things that are very, like, girl-centric and stuff, even though they're not girl-exclusive, because, you know, I love that boys can, little boys especially, can be comfortable watching a princess movie or reading a princess comic and, like, think it's awesome. So I know that a lot of my guy feminist friends get an equal amount of crap on the internet for being feminist. And, you know, it's like, it's awful, and it can be horrible. So I was just wondering if you ever had to go through the troll problem that other people have gone through.
I have. It's interesting. I was talking about this on an interview the other day, and that the current issue of Pirate Princess that comes out has a lot of troll-related conversations that happen in it about, you know, things that women encounter in life and sort of largely on the internet right now. I was remarking that it almost never happens to me on Twitter. I almost never get any kind of backlash about stuff that I post, you know, that be it, you know, feminist or about race issues or about anything like that on Twitter. It's almost always on Tumblr that I get blowback on things, because that's between the two social media platforms. That's where I spend most of my time, is one of those two. And it recently occurred to me that, you know, on Twitter, it has, like, I have my name. Like, it says, you know, I have a screen name, but it says Jeremy Whitley on there. But on Tumblr, it's just princelesscomic.tumblr.com. And a lot of the guys who decide to jump in there and give me shit and get in long, extended, you know, internet fistfights with me, I started realizing that they think I'm a girl. You know, and they say things to me that make that obvious, you know, and sort of misgender me in that way. And it's remarkable just how clearly and obviously you can tell that it's a bullying relationship. And they don't feel like they can get away with bullying another guy, but when they don't know or aren't sure that I'm a guy, they're more than happy to just wade in and you know, start throwing shit at me, which, you know, I think is a very clearly a you know, a sort of microcosm for, you know, just the amount of shit that women have to put up with generally on a day-to-day basis, because, you know, I don't get a lot of shit from people in general, because I'm a, you know, 6'2", 300-pound guy. You know, people don't start shit with me generally. But, you know, it's a completely different world to have ideas and opinions as a woman, rather whether it's on the internet or in real life.
Yeah, absolutely. I've actually considered at times, and I don't get it that bad. I mean, I have friends who get it far, 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 far. I really, you know, I'm one of the luckier ones. But I just, knowing that I can't handle it at all, I mean, there are days when I don't know what happens to me on certain days, where I just sort of turn, like, maniacal, and I start laughing about it so much that I just want to tease them back, and I feel like I'm cackling, like I'm like the Joker. I'm like, oh God, how can I get back at them? How can I do? And then there's another part of me that's like, you know, maybe I should do an experiment. Maybe I should make a fake profile with a guy's picture and, you know, pass myself off as a guy and see what it's like. And yet I can't bring myself to do it for some reason. I'm like, no, that's giving them exactly what they want. They want you to hide. And I'm just like, I am so the opposite of hiding, as everybody knows. You know, that I can't even seem to bring myself to do that as an experiment. But I just finished reading Felicia Day's memoir, and she does actually, in the very end of the book, she gets into Gamergate, and she talked about why it took her a really long time to even talk about the subject and stand up for anybody. And it was because a year before, she had already been going through her own absolute hellish nightmare online, to the point where when they started doxing her home address and everything, a stalker showed up to her house and made his way, like, into her house. And, you know, and this was, like, before Gamergate.
Yeah.
You know, so I can imagine her hesitation for ever wanting to stand up for anything after a nightmare like that. So I'm like, you know, a couple people have, you know, they talk about the releasing of the celebrity naked photos or hacking into even the ones who aren't really celebrities but nerd celebrities. You know, I'm like, you know, what are you going to do to me? I put my entire life online. There's literally, like, nothing you can do.
Yeah. And, I mean, I admire the hell out of you know, women like yourself and like, you know, so many of the women in the games and comics industry that are, you know, are out there every day and are just, you know, taking people down and taking people on, whether, you know, it's, I mean, some people are afraid, some people are not, some people are acting like they're not, but, you know, have got to be to some extent because, you know, these are clearly people who, you know, they have issues, be they with boundaries or mental health or what, that, you know, are willing to go places that, you know, you would not imagine normal people would go. And, you know, I think it's much more, you know, I have a lot of people sort of pat me on the back and thank me for taking people's sides, but it's much easier to be, you know, the guy taking women's sides than it is to be, you know, the women who are actually online standing up for themselves, dealing with that kind of shit every day. Because, you know, when I'm done arguing, I'm still, you know, a 6'2", 300-pound guy, and, like, it's very unlikely that anybody's going to mess with me, but, you know, it's been made clear time and time again that people are willing to mess with girls on the internet. So, you know, I admire the hell out of people who are, you know, who get out there and stand up against these people.
It's, you know, some of those things where, and I always find it funny that as soon as I see a post of any kind that refers to social justice warriors, I'm like, I know I'm going to be blocking you. First of all, very term. We all actually love it. And white knighting. And I'm like, a white knight is a good guy. So, you know, but they are always like, oh, they're only being fake good because they want to fuck you. And I'm like, well, I'm pretty sure that there are plenty of guys who are just think you're a dick.
Yeah, and I mean, that's so reflective of the people saying it because they're such assholes that they can't conceive of the fact that there would be anybody who is not in this just for themselves, who, you know, thinks that people ought to be treated better and that, you know, it's about, that it's actually just about being a good person and, you know, standing up for the people, you know, either that you care about in many cases or just that, you know are righteous in this case, who are, you know, standing up and doing the right thing when doing the right thing is difficult. And, you know, I think it says more about those people that they think that social justice is a bad word, and they think that that it negatively affects people to say that they're social justice warriors, that the idea of political correctness, you know, of actually doing very little, making very little actual effort to just do and say things in a way that's not horribly offensive and doesn't make other people's lives harder, that you know, they think that that's some sort of horrible thing that, like, I've had to give up whatever my real opinions are to be a decent person. You know, it says so much more about them that they think that not being an asshole is giving something up.
I'm guessing these are the people that are supporting Trump.
Yeah, they must be. I don't know who else it is.
I'm not supporting him at all. And yet, so he seems to espouse the same sort of rhetoric that they do, that the internet trolls do. And they, I mean, he has enough books, so he's basically written Bibles for them to study. But it's just, yeah. Well, I, you know, as just a woman in the business, I appreciate when guys are willing to, you know, not that they need to, you know, not the mansplaining part. That's, you know, that's a whole different thing. But just to get in there and just go, you know, I think you guys need to back off. it's okay. Because sometimes we can fight our own fight. A lot of times we can. But a lot of times we're fucking tired. And we're, you know, we just don't want to deal with it that day. Getting, you know, getting away from the internet for a day or two is a phenomenal experience. I definitely recommend it.
Yeah, I don't.
You know, it's hard.
That's the thing I have the hardest time with, is I don't know how women on the internet do it just from a amount of time it takes up standpoint. Because, I mean, that's been my only breaking point with stuff, especially on, like, on social media, is just having to go, like, you know what, I could be here with this shit all day, and I wouldn't be any closer to getting any work done. So I've got to decide to go do the work that is hopefully going to make a difference, rather than just continue to plug away at trying to convince this idiot that he's an idiot.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, because I like to have the internet there for me, because I definitely do toggle, but I find that when I'm really involved in a scene or something, I'm okay with not even toggling over to browser at all. But I need it for research. A lot of the stuff that I write is historical fiction. Even if it's just, you know, a word, or if it's how would I describe, you know, a handbag from the 19th century or something. You know, like, just things. I like to use that as a crutch.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, you know, and it's a total rabbit hole. Like, I had a wonderful epiphany the other day of something that I was going to completely change my story. And I was like, oh, like, I, you know, and it happened because I was looking in a book. I was, like, actually on my floor with a book. And I got up and immediately went to the internet and just started, like, looking up pictures and, you know, whatever kind of research there was and what the folklore was. And so I love going down that rabbit hole of the internet. It's hard for me to turn it off. But I know there are some people who actually have, like, a timing system where they can't get online if they have their writing program open or if their drawing program. I think Gabriel Hardman is one of these people. He actually has it, like, turned off, and he has, like, all the apps off his phone and stuff. I'm like, I can't go that far.
I mean, there are days that I very much feel like I need to do that. There are days that, you know, I'm writing and I realize that I don't know all the details of this thing that I want to write about, or I need to double-check a thing, or, you know, just get a visual reference for a thing even. And you know, that's the hardest part, is going on there and getting that information that I need and then getting the hell out of there before I get sucked into something.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's just, you know, the break of just not having it constantly is really wonderful. Like, even, you know, enjoy your weekends, or if you slate a day off. Some people can't take, you know, whatever, 2 days off. But if you can slate a day off, enjoy it, take your kids to the park, whatever you're going to do. I think it's refreshing, and it's a little bit of, like, regenerating. Once you stop, you know, the headaches will stop. Uh-huh. I can't even look at a screen that long anymore. I'm basically, like, a half-a-day person now. I like, really cranked out a bunch of stuff today. And by after 5 hours, I'm like, that's all I'm doing. I'm like, now I'm going to rest, and I'm going to eat, and I'm going to wait until 9 o'clock to do this podcast, and I'm drinking some whiskey, so I'm okay.
Yeah, it's one of those things that I always feel I always feel weak for, you know, sitting in front of a computer for 8 hours and feeling exhausted afterwards because, like, I didn't really do anything. I just fake did stuff. But it's still so exhausting, especially when you're dealing with a lot of this stuff that's online. You know, actually just putting up with some of that is it's too much.
But I will we'll let that go because I do appreciate it. But I wanted to, before I let you go, I wanted to find out about your Marvel project because I know that I saw the tweets going out about it, but I actually don't know what it is and I don't know anything about it. So I want to hear about this.
Yeah, so it's a one-shot anthology book that's part of Secret Wars, and it's called Secret Love. It's a romance anthology using Marvel superhero characters. So it's a variety of little up to 8-page stories done by a variety of very talented people. My story in it is a Danny Rand and Misty Knight story. All about an older and married Danny Rand and Misty Knight who have sort of put down roots and had a kid and stopped being superheroes and are now at that point in their marriage where they're sort of experiencing just sort of getting under each other's feet and trying to live together and not having the sort of luxury of just running off to a mystical realm and disappearing for 6 months or whatever. And it's that feel after you've been with somebody for a certain time that maybe you've lost your spark, lost whatever it is that made you guys. It's really interesting because it's a very personal story to me, and it's still a superhero story, but it's no costumes. They're all in normal clothes, and it's illustrated by Guri Hiru, who is amazing. Who do they draw the Avatar Last Airbender books for Dark Horse, as well as a variety of other books here and there. And it's brilliant looking. In addition to my story, there's a story by Katie Cook about bug superheroes, and there's a Michelle Fife story about Daredevil, and there's a story with Kamala Khan and Robbie Reyes. So it's a nice wide variety of stuff. And Marguerite Bennett and Chris Anka do a story about Squirrel Girl winning a date with Thor.
Okay, I saw people talking about that, and I had no idea what they were talking about. I thought it was like some crazy fan story. Because like that needs to happen. It's such a great question on Twitter.
Yeah, it's just it's a small 3-page story, but it's laugh out loud, funny, brilliant little. Both a great Thor and a great Squirrel Girl story. And yeah, it's a wide range of tones and types of stories and types of art, which I think is what makes a really great and interesting anthology. And we actually found out yesterday, the day it came out, that with all the reorders of it, it's actually already sold out through Diamond. So hopefully we'll be looking at a second print somewhere soon. But there are still plenty of stores out there that have copies on hand if people can find them.
That's awesome. Now the characters that you worked on, Damian, Iron Fist, correct? And Misty Knight. So I have barely read anything with either of them, like maybe an issue two of each. Were they ever a couple previously?
Oh yeah. So I mean.
History, because I don't know, I really don't know anything about them.
I mean, they're one of the first, if not the first, interracial couple in comics. And that They've been around since I think it started with the 70s. And they've been sort of an on again, off again thing. They're both heroes for hire. You know, Danny is obviously a kung fu master, and Misty is to some extent sort of a blaxploitation, you know, Foxy Brown type character. From the 70s. Every few years there's a good story of theirs that pop up. I was a big fan of in Fraction, Brubaker, and Aja's run on Immortal Iron Fist. They did several really good stories with the two of them.
I remember filing those when I was down at the comic store. But the issues that I read, particularly with Misty Knight, were, like, I read her in something that was like a chick book. It was just like the female heroes, actually called Heroes Prior, I think. So I never saw them together. That's so weird that this is like historically what should have been there. I was going to give you complete credit for putting these two characters together.
Yeah, it's thing in the day. For a good chunk of time, they kind of broke up. Misty Knight and Danny Rand. To this point, as far as I know, the characters are not together in the mainline Marvel universe because of some questionable, I think, decisions on the side of some writers to have a story where Misty was. During the Iron Fist run, Misty got pregnant, and it was right at the end of that run. And then the next time it gets picked up is in the Heroes for Hire book that came out around the time of I want to say it was right before Fear itself started. And they were like, "Oh, Misty's not pregnant anymore." It turns out in Phantom Pregnancy, it was a horrible. It's a horrible thing, Danny kind of disappeared, and they're kind of broken up now. So, yeah, it was a very poor and questionable ending to that story in order to write the next story. And it's, they've sort of gone back and forth with, maybe they'll get back together, in Fearless Defenders. They're sort of hinted to be together, or at least somewhat together. At this point, there's neither of them are really in major books.
Well, hopefully, I kept thinking that there would be whether it was Danny Rand or whether it was somebody else. I don't know. I thought maybe we'd see them in one of these like Netflix. Something that I, whether it was just people talking about their wish list of things, I would like to see that. I have, honestly, because I checked out of Daredevil, I'm like the one person that didn't actually get into it. I
really enjoyed Daredevil, but that was the one I was least looking forward to, are the ones they've announced, because the Jessica Jones one is next. I think she's a really interesting character, and that will also be introducing Luke Cage, who is the subject of the one after that, I adore Luke as well. And then the fourth one, the fourth original character that they've got is Iron Fist. And there hasn't really been any casting news or anything for that yet. So I'm hoping that we'll get to see at least Misty Knight, if not both Misty and Colleen Wing, who's her best friend and crime-fighting cohort. They haven't said one way or another whether Misty is appearing, but I very much hope that she does, because it would be a much-needed change of pace to the stories about dudes, or even in, even in the few cases that there are women in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, stories about white women in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Yeah, exactly. The studios, you have to see that fan's line. And it's one of those things where I get upset when creators say, well, then you need to vote with your dollars. No, no, because a lot of people, I don't think Agent Carter necessarily had the viewership of something bigger, but the fans really spoke out.
Yeah.
So I think that's why we're getting more.
I love Agent Carter, and you know, it had a lot of things working against it, and it was a short run TV show, as compared to, you know, what they initially gave Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Also, it's a historical drama in addition to being a superhero TV show, so you're not going to necessarily have the same audience for those two things. In a lot of respects, it's the superhero version of Mad Men. I think there's obviously an audience for it, and a very vocal audience who has done a good job showing that they love it and why they love it. And I'm glad it's coming back, and hopefully at some point we'll see more of a commitment to that character and stories like that from ABC, if not from the cinematic universe.
I completely agree. It's good to have more choices, more things, because that way if I can say, hey, I like Daredevil, I can find something else that I do like, and it's, so more things are good. Jeremy, let me let you go, because it's really late. I'm, if I keep drinking whiskey, I'm just going to keep sweating more. But where can people find you and follow you? I know you've mentioned Tumblr and Twitter, so repeat those.
Yeah, so I am on primarily Tumblr and Twitter. Tumblr is princelesscomic.tumblr.com, and I talk about Princeless and Pirate Princess, but also a lot about other projects I'm working on, be they pony related or Marvel or whatever else comes up next that I'll get to tell people about. In addition to that, I'm on Twitter at jrome58. It's JROME 58. Or if you search Jeremy Whitley, there's I think two that show up. I'm the one that's not a British accountant. I'm on there frequently, and people can feel free to ask me any questions or throw ideas out there at me, because I'm always happy to engage people and talk online. Those are the primary places to find me. I also do have a website, which I am currently working on actually putting anything on, at jeremywhitley.com. So people can check me out there if they like. It's a little unimpressive at the moment, but hopefully it'll be more impressive as time goes on.
Very cool. Are you doing any more shows for the rest of the
year? Yes, I am doing all of September. I am doing Dragon Con in Atlanta the first weekend of September, and then I will be the next weekend in South Carolina for Florence Comic Con. The weekend after that, I am in Bethesda, Maryland for SPX. And then I think I have a whole week off, and then I'll be heading off to New York Comic Con at the beginning of October. And then other than North Carolina Comic Con right here in beautiful Durham, North Carolina in November, that'll pretty much wrap me up.
That's a really full schedule.
Yeah, that's just the last couple months of the year, so...
Well, guys, you can follow me on Twitter at Elizabeth Amber, and please go to patreon.com/AmberUnmasked to sponsor the show. All of these show notes, in case you wanted to go back and look at anything, is at amberunmasked.com.